Separating the policy from the politics, delving deeper into what is happening in our world today, and sharing the information you may not know if you didn't listen to this show. iHub Radio presents The Lovable Liberal. This is the Anita Rufus Show, civil discourse on current events and politics. Here's Anita.
And again, I thank you so much for joining me live on Thursdays from 1 to 3 here at iHub Radio. And you can always find podcasts available at the iHubRadio.com website or wherever you get your podcasts. Just enter iHub and Anita Rufus and the podcast will come up. By the way, the show is also repeated on the weekends. If you miss it on a Thursday, you can catch it on, I think, Saturday or Sunday morning. You can find all the schedule of all of the shows for iHub at the iHubRadio.com website. I want to talk a bit about the economy. There were some very interesting things that came up this past week about the economy, and I think it's important for us to keep some perspective about what's going on, although I will acknowledge up front, I really don't understand the economy and how it works very well. For example, I read a whole article about the Fed and how the Fed operates and the control of interest rates and the control of the value of the dollar and why things are okay now by comparison with what's going on in China or somewhere else. I don't know. They might as well be speaking a foreign language for me. It's just not, my brain doesn't work that way. Because I haven't been trained that way. I never took an economics class in college. Well, I take that back. I did take one class that touched on economics, but it was an environmental science class that I had to take, and I never quite understood the environmental science either. But there were parts of the economy thrown into it, and I just never got it. My brain doesn't. However, I'm not stupid. I can understand basic numbers and what they seem to indicate. So with regard to the economy, let me just go back with a little bit of history because I think we forget sometimes in the heat of the moment and in the heat of a political argument being made in the moment. Under Ronald Reagan, the be-all and end-all for traditional Republicans, the debt that this country owed went up three times over what it had been when he came in. And that was primarily because of tax cuts. Now, we often hear about the deficit and the debt. This much I do know. The deficit is how far behind we are in a given year in what's coming in taxes and fees, and what has to go out to fund programs. That's the deficit. And for what it's worth, most states cannot run a deficit. Most states have to find some way to raise enough money, either through taxes or fees, or by selling bonds to support various projects, where people invest in what is possible for a future payout. States can't run deficits, but the federal government can. So under Reagan, the debt, which is the accumulation of how much deficit year to year we have had. So if you have a $5 billion deficit the first year and a $10 billion deficit the second year, you now have $15 billion in debt that you've had to borrow to cover whatever it was that led to the deficit. So under Reagan, the debt went up by three times. It then came down after Reagan with Democratic presidents up until George W. Bush, again, tax cuts. The be-all and end-all philosophy of the Republican Party. We've got to cut taxes. Well, when you cut taxes, less money comes in. And if you don't compensate for that, especially with a growing population, where you're going to need more services, not less, you're going to run deficits, which then add to the debt. Obama, when he came in, inherited the terrible recession, and it took time to turn it around, but they did turn it around, and the economy was growing. And then Donald Trump came in, and what did the first thing he did? Tax cuts for the top 5%. Now, the debt, we have a lot of debt, but nobody seems particularly concerned about it. And in fact, President Biden, in his proposals for the infrastructure program and the human programs that he wants to try and institute, which would help us all have better lives, the concern of the Republicans is, oh, we can't afford that. They were able to afford the tax cuts under Donald Trump and under George Bush and under Ronald Reagan. If you don't invest in expansion, and if necessary, run up the debt, the idea is to invest in that expansion toward the future. You don't raise taxes just to pay off what you've already spent. You raise taxes so that you have enough money for the kinds of programs that will take you forward to generating more income and more economy, if you will, and more control and participation in the world economy, so that you can pay off the debt and not run all these deficits. And by the way, when you hear the Republicans throwing around all this, well, you know, Joe Biden is just giving away the store to China. We don't owe most of our debt to China. The country to which we owe the most in debt is Japan. Meanwhile, United States employers added over 900,000 jobs in March. And pay attention, when you start hearing all this stuff about the economy, the use of words is very, very important. When it says they added that number of jobs, that doesn't mean they created that many new jobs. It means the economy added 900,000 active workers, some of which were brand new jobs created and some of which were jobs that people had lost during the pandemic that have now been brought back. So there's a difference between we added jobs and we created jobs. The hiring was fueled by the fact that more and more people have been vaccinated, that we had another round of federal aid, so people have more money to spend, and the fact that states are loosening. Some states are totally opening, and they're, unfortunately, some of them are on the list of the biggest increases in virus cases. But states are at least reopening. For example, here in the desert area, you can still go to a restaurant that has outdoor capable seating, and most of them have found a way to put some tables outside. Some of them are even doing it by taking over a lane on the street. So you can get tables outside, and some restaurants will even take reservations. Many of them you just have to line up when you get there and hope people get up. And I went to one restaurant for lunch where when they seated me, they said, we prefer if you can limit your lunch to 45 minutes to an hour because we want to turn over tables. We have a lot of people who would. Hey, I get it. And locally, at least for now, restaurants are able to seat people inside for about 25% of their total capacity. In a few more weeks, they'll be open for full capacity indoors, and you'll still have the ability to eat outside. And I must say, it really, for somebody who doesn't like to cook and has been stuck trying to figure out what we're going to eat for dinner every night for a year, I can't wait to be able to be waited on. I don't care what it costs. Anyway, employers added 916,000 jobs in March, and it's a turning point. It was the third straight month of accelerated hiring, and they're expecting even more gains in the months ahead. And in case you didn't know, guess what happened during this last year of the pandemic? The rich got richer. Duh. A new billionaire was made every 17 hours over the past year. That's more than seven in a week. The world's wealthiest are now $5 trillion with a T, $5 trillion richer than they were a year ago. Jeff Bezos has been declared the richest person in the world for the fourth straight year, and his fortune is estimated at $175 billion. Elon Musk is now number two, up from number 31. Boy, what a year he had. And his worth is now said to be $151 billion. Bernard Arnault and his family, who own the Moët Hennessy Louis Vuitton companies, that family is worth $150 billion. Bill Gates is number four at $124 billion. And number five is Mark Zuckerberg at $97 billion. And Warren Buffett fell to only $96 billion. By the way, you will notice that out of the top six, five are Americans. Well, I assume Elon Musk is an American. Forbes has said that there are now a record 2,755 billionaires in the world worth $13 trillion. And this past year, 493 people were newcomers to the billionaire list. And guess who made the list? Kim Kardashian. She's now a billionaire. Now, I mentioned early in the show that women are kind of leading the way in the worldwide economy. Treasury Secretary for the U.S., Janet Yellen, Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai, the European Central Bank is led by Christine Lagarde. The International Monetary Fund is being led by Kristalina Georgieva. The World Trade Organization is being run by Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. Women are running the finance ministries in 16 countries, 14 of the world's central banks. Europe will end 2021 with a smaller economy than 2019. Asia is seeing booming growth in China and India, and the U.S. is doing pretty well.
She's lovable, she's liberal, and she's here to bring a tone of civility to political discussion you aren't likely to find anywhere else. The Anita Rufus Show with your lovable liberal on iHub Radio. Here's Anita.
Okay, a correction, a slight correction. We did double check one thing during the break. Elon Musk, who, as I mentioned, went from number 31 to number 2 on the world billionaires list. Elon Musk is an American, but he is also Canadian and he is also South African. And for what it's worth, you know, you can be a citizen of more than one country. I know somebody who is a citizen of the U.S. and Canada, but was born in Britain, so still has British citizenship. I have stepchildren who are citizens of the United States because they were born here, but they are also citizens of Canada because their father was a Canadian citizen. And just because you have citizenship in more than one country doesn't mean you're not a loyal whatever country you're in. Now, I want to talk about the Biden administration plans as things are moving forward. I have to say, I think Joe Biden is the right man at the right time for this country after what we have been through for the last 4 years with really chaos and an almost deliberate, maybe it's not almost, a deliberate dismantling of the capability of government. When somebody says America first, and what they mean is however I want it to be is how it's going to be, that's not America first. That is an individual personality first. I remember when Ronald Reagan came into office and said, government is the problem. And yet, when you need to get your driver's license renewed, you want to be able to go to the DMV and get it. When you need your passport renewed, you want to be able to send something in to the federal government and get it. The systems of the government that are put in place to work for all of us are necessary. And whoever is in the White House, while they may have their own idea about policy pursuits, nevertheless, one of their jobs is to make sure that government works for the people. Now, the president has come out with his plan for infrastructure. And there's already some discussion and dispute about what infrastructure even means.
He's trying to expand the definition of infrastructure. Infrastructure should just be roads and bridges.
Well, maybe we'll also throw in things like dams so that water doesn't flood surrounding communities. Maybe we should throw in things like the electrical grid, because without that infrastructure, we don't have any electricity. South Dakota's Republican Governor Kristi Noem said she doesn't think that pipes and housing are infrastructure. Pipes? Do we want kids drinking lead in the water? If that isn't infrastructure, I don't know what is. But the Republicans are kind of messaging infrastructure should only mean roads and bridges. And Biden's plan is arguing for a much broader definition of what constitutes infrastructure. To me, infrastructure has to include rail lines and buses. That's part of transportation. That's not unlike roads and the need for bridges, and trains have to go on rails, and you have parts of an airline travel, things that connect us from one place to another. That's infrastructure. The electric grid is infrastructure. The Wi-Fi grid in this day and age, with our reliance on computing, the Wi-Fi grid is infrastructure. And think about the fact that school buildings needing to be upgraded with appropriate air conditioning systems, with ceilings that don't leak, and desks where children don't have to share a desk, for God's sake, which does happen in this country. And it is especially in low-income housing areas where pipes are not kept up, where the infrastructure may not extend. Public transportation, so that people can, in fact, get to work. There are people today in this country who live in poor areas, who work full-time, who walk 5 or 6 hours each direction to get to work and get home because they can't afford a car or because they live where there's only rutted back roads. When Donald Trump left office, some Republicans stopped counting rail and water pipe investment as infrastructure. How convenient. Now they can say, well, we're not going to support what President Biden wants. That's not infrastructure. Well, they thought it was when they thought the money was coming into their district.
The Lovable Liberal continues now on iHub Radio. Here's Anita Rufus.
So the Biden administration is putting out a lot of policy suggestions that they are hoping Congress will back. And there are a couple of ways this can happen in the way our government runs. The White House can draft policy and send it to Congress, and then Congress can do whatever they do with it. And let me just give you an idea, you know, oh, by the way, or the alternative is the White House can just make a suggestion for a result they would like to see and leave it up to Congress to figure out how to get there. But here's one of the reasons why it is so hard to write a bill in Congress. For example, there are businesses that are eligible to get relief loans under some of the bills that have been passed in Congress to help small businesses. Well, one kind of small business is known as a predatory debt collector. Some of us who owe money occasionally hear from these kinds of businesses. Well, do we want predatory debt collectors to get relief under these pandemic bills or not? Because if not, that has to be written in to the bills as an exception. Being able to think through every possible scenario where, for example, grifters could find a way to benefit. We've seen the cases where prisoners have been able to collect all kinds of money because they were not excluded from getting the payments that were meant to bring us back from the brink as a result of the virus. And it's the job of staff. You often hear about members of Congress having staffs. That's what these staffs do. They try and think through every possible exception that might be needed to a bill. And sometimes the exceptions they come up with or the inclusions they come up with are not satisfactory to the rest of the Congress. And that's where arguments take place or horse trading, swapping one thing for another takes place. But ultimately, there are those in Congress who make the ultimate judgment. And by the way, this is the reason why you hear them say, well, nobody had a chance to read the bill. The bill was 5,000 pages long. Well, it's because all of these bills have these little things that either include or exclude certain things from the policy that are necessary to think through. Do we want those people to be included in this category or not? You know, if you're going to mention, for example, there was a time when it was enough to say LGBT. In fact, there was LGB. Those were the original people who were included in policy that might affect those who are gay. Then we added T because LGB didn't include trans people. Did we mean to exclude them by not mentioning them? If you mention them, they're included. Well, then we added the Q because there are people who self-identify as queer who don't really fit into those other categories neatly. What difference does it make? The goal is to have the policy cover all the people it is meant to cover. And there is someone in the Senate who has a great deal of power beyond just Chuck Schumer, who is the head of the majority, and Mitch McConnell, who is the leader of the minority at the moment in Senate. There is a nonpartisan Senate official who has great power, and that position is called the parliamentarian. Now, any of you who have ever belonged to an organization that ran on Robert's Rules of Orders know what a parliamentarian does. They're the person who supposedly truly understands all of the parliamentary rules for how to run the organization, how to run meetings, what the committees do, what officers you have to have. Well, there's a parliamentarian in the Senate. And the parliamentarian in the Senate, at the moment it's a woman, the parliamentarian in the Senate is a nonpartisan Senate official. And that parliamentarian can rule on how certain types of legislation must be brought forward within the rules of the Senate that the Senate has agreed to. Now, this thing called reconciliation, which is how the first recovery bill that Biden pushed through got through on a simple majority vote, not requiring 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. That first one went through as a reconciliation bill, meaning we already passed a budget, but there are details in that budget about how that money's going to be spent and where it's going to be spent and who it's going to be spent on that we didn't specify, so now we can do that. And that's what they did with that first bill that put $1,400 into the pockets of a lot of people in this country after $600 earlier on under Trump. And the parliamentarian let that bill go through for the Biden administration on a simple majority vote because the parliamentarian said it could go through under reconciliation. It didn't have to be a separate bill that would have to get 60 votes. Well, guess what the parliamentarian ruled this week? The Democrats took the parliamentarian, the suggestion for some of the additional bills they want to pass, including the infrastructure bill that has been proposed, and including another bill that has been proposed, which is about people issues. And the Senate parliamentarian said, well, you know what? You can pass those other two bills over the next 2 years with just a majority vote. You don't have to go for the 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. This is a huge decision that will benefit the Democrats. However, not all Democrats are on the same page either, so they're going to have to put in all those little nuances and considerations that can at least get all the Democrat votes, and then a tied vote in the Senate can be broken by the vice president. Now, there are some issues around this because Mitch McConnell has said no matter what the Biden administration puts out, the Republicans are not going to help. Republicans in Congress are making the bet that it is more advantageous for them to oppose all of Joe Biden's policies and hope that the voters will buy into whatever arguments they want to make next year in 2022 when some of the senators are up for re-election and you could have seats changing party, and when every single member of the House of Representatives is up. Normally, that midterm election after a presidential election, the in-between election, normally seats change hands and go to the party that is not in the White House. But not always. If the people like the plans that Biden is putting forward and want to help pass those plans, they have the ability to increase the majority of Democrats in the House and increase the number of senators. But in the meantime, the parliamentarian has said, you know what? The stuff that you're trying to put forward, you can do that through reconciliation. You only need 51 votes. So no matter what McConnell says about whether the Republicans will help or not, the one comment I have about that, I am saddened, truly saddened for our country that Republican members of the Senate and the House cannot think for themselves and for the people they are there to represent and will fall in line just because their leader says, this is what you got to do. Maybe it's a good thing I wasn't elected to the House of Representatives, because I would not have been a go-along-to-get-along kind of person. Now, this second bill that the Biden administration wants to put forward is going to focus on people issues, not just the infrastructure. And there's enough problems with the infrastructure bill because there are a lot of considerations about the environment in it. And it's going to take time and it's not going to be easy. But the second bill is more focusing on people issues, things like health care and education and paid and family leave. And the Biden administration has suggested how they will pay for all of this stuff. Tax increases, raising the corporate tax rate from 21 back to 28%, which is still less than it was before Donald Trump came in and lowered it. That would be worth about $730 billion raised over 10 years. Impose a global minimum tax on profits from foreign subsidiaries. Just because a company decides to locate overseas doesn't mean that they shouldn't still have to pay taxes on the money they earn. And that would raise around over $500 billion. Biden wants to tax capital gains as regular income for the wealthy and tax unrealized capital gains at death, which is, the Republicans like to call that the death tax, but it's not. And unless your estate is worth over $1 million, you wouldn't have to pay it anyway. In fact, I think it's even higher than that. He also wants to return the top individual tax rate, but only for those making $400,000 a year or more. And that would go back to 39.6%, which is what it was before Trump cut taxes for the wealthy. Now, the Republicans plan to spend about $25 million on TV and digital ads targeting members of Congress in vulnerable districts to get them to vote against these policies. But the health care plan would extend the 2-year provision of the COVID relief package for everyone who stays on Obamacare. It would have universal pre-K and free community college. So public education would start at age 3 and end 2 years after high school. And it would also extend family and paid leave. And it must include universal child care, or I would not support it. We have to allow women to get back to work.
The Lovable Liberal continues now on iHub Radio. Here's Anita Rufus.
Okay. The Trump campaign fundraising scam. I love this story. This is the story about the 63-year-old man who was battling cancer, lived in Kansas City on less than $1,000 a month. He wanted to donate to Donald Trump, and he said he would donate $500, which for him was a stretch, but that's how much he cared about the president. And this was at a time late in the cycle of the last election where the Trump campaign needed money. Well, as it turns out, this man battling cancer donated the $500 online, and the next day they hit him for another $500. And then $500 the week after that, and then $500 the week after that, and on it went until he was $3,000 into the Trump campaign in less than 30 days. He thought he was a victim of fraud. "It felt like a scam," he said. "Ha, you think?" This was this Trump campaign online website to raise money, and it was one of those where down at the bottom of the page in real small print, it said, "This amount will be the amount you are donating today will be deducted from your account every week until the election, unless you uncheck this box." And it was in tiny print, and the box was checked, and most people never pay attention to all the fine print anyway. Well, it turns out that they had to recover $122.7 million in refunds for people who had had this money taken out and didn't know that it was going to come out every week because they hadn't read the fine print and who couldn't afford it. The Trump operation had to refund 10.7% of the money it raised on that site. But guess what? They raised enough money to get through the campaign. It was one of the largest refunds that any campaign ever had to make for online contributions. But what may be even more important is that for the Trump campaign, it was like getting an interest-free loan. They borrowed the money they needed to finish the campaign from their own voters. And then, hey, okay, we have to pay it back. How did they pay it back? Remember all the people who donated to stop the steal after the election? Meanwhile, the cost to taxpayers of the former president keep going up. Normal perks given to an ex-president, things like office space and security and travel, up to $1 million. The cost to taxpayers of Trump's lies about the election have left taxpayers with a large and ever-growing bill that is already totaled more than $500 million. Legal fees for the lawsuits that were filed and had to be defended by the government. Heightened security in response to death threats against poll workers. Repairs that were needed in Washington, D.C. after the January 6th insurrection. All of these costs add up. And we're not done yet because we're still having to pay for National Guard troops to protect what should be an open area accessible to any citizen of this country who wants to see and be near the center of power. Now, we know about what's going on with this Matt Gaetz guy. What a piece of work this guy is. The ultimate frat boy rich boy. As it turns out, Matt Gaetz fought a revenge porn bill saying that ex-lovers ought to be able to use nude photos of previously involved partners however they want to. he was totally against the idea of a bill that would protect against what is known as revenge porn. He thought the picture is his to do with as he wanted. It's an expression of his rights. This guy is such a sleaze. It's a contest whether he's worse than the person he adores in Donald Trump. And what is it about the Republicans and sex, for God's sake? Confronted with a leaked phone call, Alabama Republican John Merrill admitted to an affair and dropped out of a race for the Senate. He's the Alabama Secretary of State, and he has now announced that he will not run for elected office next year after a leaked phone call exposed an extramarital affair that he had previously denied. So it's kind of an interesting question if you think about it. What makes somebody more unelectable? The fact that they had an extramarital affair, or the fact that they lied about it? I think it's an interesting question. I'm not sure which one says something worse about the person that you're talking about. Now, this is something that is disturbing. Huntington Beach, California, and Newport Beach, California, have been inundated with flyers that were sent to homes, dropped on driveways and front porches on Easter Sunday morning. Flyers that featured KKK propaganda and the fact that white lives do matter, and that a White Lives Matter rally would be scheduled for April 11th in Huntington Beach, California. Local residents were up in arms because they just don't think that that's either appropriate or something that they would want in their community. And the images and event information were in fact widely disseminated across social media. Now, Black Lives Matter does have a chapter in Huntington Beach, and they are planning a counter rally. But we as a people need to make it clear, as a country and as a culture, that it is not okay for obvious white supremacists to not be shunned by society. They may have a First Amendment right to say what they want to say, but by God, they shouldn't be able to feel like it's okay. Also, Stanford coach Tara Vanderveer, all-time winningest coach in the NCAA Division I women's basketball history. This woman has had over 1,100 career basketball wins. Hey, have a good week. Stay tuned because coming up next, New York Times bestselling author Todd Goldberg on his book, The Low Desert.